is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team, Jim Poplava and Chris Prytower.
The U.S. job market strengthened in November, unemployment fell to a half-century low, and stocks and bond yields climb on the strength of the U.S. economy. Hello and welcome to the Financial Sense News Hour. My name is Chris Prytower, and on this edition of the News Hour, Gina Martin Adams says the slowdown in economic indicators appears to be behind us, and she shares Bloomberg's 2020 view. Also joining us is Greg Weldon, who discusses dollar weakness and the areas of the market that he's excited about. Chris Sheridan gives us this week's market wrap-up report, and then later joins Financial Sense Wealth Management's Chief Investment Officer Chris Poplava in a discussion about the spike in so-called thin air credit this quarter. That's the expansion of money in the economy when you look at the Fed and commercial banks. He also explains why there's a divergence right now between the two main manufacturing gauges for the U.S. and gives an update on what we here at Financial Sense Wealth Management are doing for clients based on the global macro outlook. All that coming up in this edition of the Financial Sense News Hour.
Well, the big news this week came out on Friday with a very strong jobs report for the month of November, pushing stocks higher across the board on the day's trading. This helped to erase the losses from Monday and Tuesday after a weaker-than-expected ISM manufacturing report. And, of course, President Trump's suggestion that a trade deal might be better if it waited until after the 2020 election. So those two reports that came out earlier this week really dropped stocks. And then Friday's strong jobs report balanced that out, basically leading to a wash in the market for the week's trading. The Dow Jones and the NASDAQ down around 0.1%, the S&P 500 up 0.2%, and the Russell 2000 up 0.6%. If stocks don't crash over the next few weeks, 2019 has turned out to be a really good year so far. Here are the numbers year to date. The Dow Jones is up 20% year to date. The NASDAQ, 30.5%. The S&P 500 up 25.5%. And the Russell 2000 up 21.2%. So very good numbers for the year so far when you look at the major market indices. Outside of stocks, this week the 10-year ended at 1.8%. The U.S. dollar index fell slightly to 97.6, and West Texas Intermediate crude saw a big jump up by 7.3% for the week, closing just under $60, as OPEC and other allies announced that they would cut oil production by an additional 500,000 barrels per day during the first quarter of 2020. On the macro front, one of the big things being discussed lately, which we dove into this week with Richard Duncan on our Insider podcast, is how the Fed is now injecting hundreds of billions of dollars into the financial system, really ever since the repo crisis broke out in September. Just in the last 3 months alone, the Fed has now injected over $300 billion into the market, meaning that they are now expanding their balance sheet each month at the fastest pace since the 2008 financial crisis. So that's pretty phenomenal. Richard Duncan saying that this is actually the most extraordinary monetary U-turn that we've seen in the Fed's history when you consider the fact that they have now gone from monetary tightening by reducing their balance sheet to expanding their balance sheet at the fastest pace that we've seen in years. Why are they doing that? Well, that is a topic of big discussion, and that's something that we did get into with Richard Duncan this week. If you want to hear what he had to say, he's definitely calling this QE4 along with a number of others, although the Fed has pushed back on that idea, saying that they do not consider this QE. He explains why it is quantitative easing. We also have some interesting data and charts that we've posted on our Twitter page or retweeted by others along these lines. If you just want to look at the data itself, check out our Twitter page, or again, you can hear what Richard Duncan had to say about this on FS Insider. We spoke spoke to the well-known speaker and author of numerous books, Richard Duncan at richardduncaneconomics.com, about his recent MacroWatch series looking at QE4 and the consequences of quantitative easing 4, the fourth program now being launched by the Federal Reserve to inject credit into the economy. Why they're doing that, what they're saying about it, why he thinks that there's some disinformation going on from the Fed about why they're doing this. And then we also look at some projections that he's making based on his figures for how much higher or how much more he expects the Federal Reserve to expand its balance sheet and inject more liquidity into the markets, the implications that will have for interest rates and for stock prices. Here's a clip of what he had to say.
When the stock market sold off in December and in May, that forced the Fed to conduct what was really quite an embarrassing monetary policy U-turn. They had to stop hiking interest rates and announce the premature end of quantitative tightening. And then in September, there was a very unusual event in the repo market. On September 17th, the interest rates in the overnight repo market shot up to 10%, whereas they should have just been 2.5%. So this was four times above where they should have traded, which signals something was very wrong. And moreover, that problem in the repo market infected the interest rates in the federal funds market as well. So the federal funds rate was supposed to be trading between 2% and 2.25%, but it shot up above that to 2.3%. So in other words, the Fed, during that episode, the Fed lost control over the federal funds rate.
So if you want to listen to this full interview with Richard Duncan about the consequences of QE4, and you aren't already a subscriber, simply go to financialsense.com and click the subscribe button.
Everyone wants to retire well. That's not as easy as it sounds. You need to make the right investment choices. Decide when to take Social Security. Plan for taxes on your retirement income and create a legacy for your family. To retire well, you need a roadmap to help you get there. Let Financial Sense Wealth Management help you navigate your way to retirement. We provide comprehensive, thoughtful, and personal retirement planning. Call Financial Sense Wealth Management now at 888-486-3939. That's 888-486-3939. Start your journey to retiring well today. Advisory services offered through Financial Sense Advisors, Inc., registered investment advisor. Securities offered through Financial Sense Securities, Inc., member FINRA, SIPC. Both companies doing business as Financial Sense Wealth Management.
The best thing about this year is, doesn't matter where you've invested, you've made money. Commodities, bonds, stocks, international stocks. I guess the question now is, with the market still going up, will investors have a cheery year, or will they get a lump of coal in their stockings? Joining us on the program is Gina Martin Adams. She's chief equity strategist at Bloomberg. And Gina, let's talk about investor sentiment. You guys follow fund flows. Money has been coming out of stock funds, going into fixed income funds. But despite that, this market seems to power on. On the day you and I are doing this interview, it was announced the president was going to be impeached. The market dipped for a minute, but as we speak, it's in positive territory.
Yeah, it's been a really fascinating year. I mean, I will say that a lot changed in the month of November. In the month of November, we actually did finally see flows into the equity market. We did finally see very risky sorts of investments dominate the risk-off tone that had really predominated the last several months. So there's a possibility that November was actually just the start of a new, more bullish upswing for stocks. I mean, with respect to impeachment, you know, you have two experiences in the post-World War II time period in which you've had impeachment, one of which was actually not particularly meaningful for stocks in 1998. And obviously, the 1970s experience was totally different. I'd say the distinguishing factor where there was the economy. So impeachment is only particularly meaningful in an environment in which economic growth is very rapidly deteriorating, depleting the outlook for earnings growth. In this particular environment, the outlook for earnings growth is actually improving incrementally. As a result, I think equities are kind of following that cue as opposed to impeachment.
Isn't it a truism with the market that when you have a growing economy, the markets are better able to absorb any kind of shocks, whether it's a sudden fallout on trade or impeachment or a geopolitical event. It just seems to, maybe it's down for a day or two or maybe a week, but then it just continues upward.
I think that might be some of it. I would add to that, when you have an easy Fed or when you have the Fed on your side, the market is also more able to absorb any sort of shock. And I think that's the really big key that changed this year relative to last year. In both years, you had a growing economy. Obviously, last year was a faster growth year than this year. The big shift is last year, which turned out to be a pretty tough year for stocks, the Fed was very tight and increasingly tight. This year, the Fed has been easing and getting increasingly easier. And that, to me, has made a big difference. Borrowing conditions are easing. The interest rate is lowering. Spreads are tightening. And that's really helpful to easing, the greasing the wheels, so to speak, of liquidity in the financial system, which has certainly helped elevate equity prices and allow us to ride the bumps of policy, ride the bumps of earnings growth and economic indicators a little bit easier in 2019 relative to 2018.
You know, there's a number of people that are talking about this. It's probably one of the longest business cycles and market cycles in history. Normally, when you get this long into the cycle, you start hearing people talking about recession. There's a few people out there talking about it. But Gina, it's hard to see that happening with consumers doing well right now. Wages are rising. Unemployment rates are low. The Wall Street Journal just did an article about people that are laid off with one particular plant in a town had companies calling them, offering them jobs. So it's hard to see anything on the horizon, at least in front of me right now, that would cause this economy to go into a recession.
Yeah, I would agree with that. As a matter of fact, we had most of our slowdown in 2019, and the slowdown in economic indicators appears to be behind us rather than in front of us. It's still difficult to see where a really rapid increase in growth is going to come from as well. That said, I think one thing that kind of goes unmentioned about this 10-year economic cycle is just how frequently we've also had massive market resets. And the equity market effectively priced for three different recessions over the course of this 10-year economic cycle. We had a massive correction last year of 20% in stocks that usually doesn't occur outside of recession. We also had a very significant correction in 2015-2016, which accompanied a pretty significant recession in the earnings for the S&P 500 earnings stream. We also had a very big correction in 2011. The result is the equity market has corrected, and in anticipation of weakening economic conditions, in each of these cases, those weakening conditions may have occurred at the margin, but certainly didn't throw the economy into recession. So I think that there is a necessity to sort of distinguish now between the economy and the equity market. They are two different entities. They don't always operate in tandem. The equity market has its own cycle, and the economy has a different cycle. Our economy is obviously in an extended cycle of very, very slow growth and very limited inflation.
So given that and the fact it looks like the Fed is sort of temporary on hold, as you look at what the Fed is doing right now, do you expect them to stay in that position for a while, or do you see anything that would alter their position to change it in either direction?
I think the Fed is on hold in terms of interest rate policy. I also think over the course of the fall, what the Fed really has been doing is not only focusing on, you know, where the equilibrium interest rate should be in line with growth conditions and inflation conditions, but what they should do with the balance sheet. And this, to me, has been the biggest change over the last couple of months. The Fed is reaccelerating the balance sheet or normalizing the balance sheet after potentially over-tightening the balance sheet through the course of the last 2 years. So I think 2020 will really be about the balance sheet. How fast do they grow the balance sheet? How do they manage the balance sheet? What are they doing with the balance sheet while they likely hold the interest rate steady? Now, that said, they are obviously very data dependent as a general rule. So should growth deteriorate more quickly or an unforeseen inflation spike start to emerge, then the Fed will certainly act with interest rates as well. But I do think the balance sheet is probably their main focus from here until the, at least in the first few months of 2020.
Well, let's talk about some of the PMIs. The latest ISM shows a further downward trend in the ISM manufacturing, but service seems to be holding up strong. Consumers are holding up strong. So let's talk about those two different sides of the economy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was very clear that The bigger mover in terms of economic growth historically is always the industrial sector. It's simply more sensitive. It's actually very rare, even in economic recession, that consumers contract spending. They just slow their spending, their rate of spending growth. So what you usually see that moves the business cycle around is an industrial business cycle. You see manufacturers really slow down their pace of order growth in response to a perceived slowdown in ultimate demand growth, and the result is usually economic recession. We have seen over the course of the last year some slowdown in manufacturing. Capital goods orders growth, which is our favored measure of kind of manufacturing activity, has fallen incrementally over the course of the last several months in comparison to a year ago pace. Now, that tends to happen pretty frequently throughout business cycles. It's very, you know, it moves a lot relative to consumption. What's happening right now is while that's slowing down, the consumer is actually still spending at a very, very healthy pace. We just got through, obviously, Black Friday and the early start to the holiday shopping season. And for all intents and purposes, the consumer generally held in there with respect to expectations. So it's creating something of a sheltering effect. I think really interestingly, what's happening in the manufacturing sector, you're getting this sort of negative signal out of the ISM surveys, which is not being confirmed by other manufacturing surveys. The ISM falling as much as it has is it's much greater, deeper decline than is being exhibited in orders. There's another survey that I like called the Market Survey of Manufacturing Activity that has yet to dip into contraction territory. And that's very consistent with those other periods of equity market weakness that were unaffiliated with economic weakness. And so I think it's consistent with, say, the 2015-2016 experience or the 2011 experience when the market reacted to a slowdown in manufacturing activity, but the consumer held in there and held in there at a relatively robust pace. And the result was the economy only felt a little wiggle rather than a recession.
So until recently, this year, it was mainly kind of the safer sectors, yield sectors, consumer staples. You had REITs, you had utilities, along with technology that was leading the market. If you look at over the last month or two, you've seen a breakout in financials, you've got in healthcare, industrials are looking better, and now we're even seeing small caps start to rise. So what is that telling you, Gina?
I think that the market rally that began with the December lows last year is broadening and deepening into 2020. I think what you had throughout the vast majority of this year was a lot of denial that the market would continue to rise. There's a lot of concern about political risk. There's a lot of concern about trade policy risk that sort of suppressed investor confidence, despite the fact that the market was rising. And now investors are sort of caving to the ultimate market trend and saying, you know what? Indicators are not as bad as we thought they would be. Maybe recession is not ultimately imminent. The market is rallying beyond our expectations. You know, we want to get a little bit of that action. And so you're seeing a broadening and a deepening of the gains that have been occurring all year. I also think the thing that happened, we started talking in August about, even though stocks were near all-time highs, the underlying dynamics of the market suggested that investors were pricing for recession. You had investors really crowding into low volatility, high defensive, high dividend yield stocks with very, very low market beta. And that was exhibited most clearly in the spread between defensive sector valuation multiples and cyclical sector valuation multiples. So when the yield curve started upward moving in a more positive direction, when the Fed started really decreasing interest rates and expanding the balance sheet, it caught all those trades off guard. And we've seen a bit of reversal of those trades. I think the most positive part of the November trade is that you saw continuation of the reversal and even more breakouts. You noted the industrials breakout, healthcare stocks starting to rally, financials starting to rally. So that recovery and breadth of the market towards cyclicals and away from defensives gives you a pretty solid degree of confidence that the market gains are likely to continue going forward.
And from a strategy point of view, what does this tell you about value versus growth? Because a lot of these industrial stocks until recently were pretty beaten up. I mean, you could get high yields on industrial stocks with low PEs. So what is that telling you now? Is it a shift more over to value in other sectors that haven't participated as you're talking about? The market is beginning to broaden.
I think it's to be determined yet. If you look at the month of November as a good example, and you really isolate growth stocks versus value stocks, a sort of agnostic of sector, what you find is growth still actually beat out value by a small margin. October was the big value reversal, and then in November, it was more value and growth kind of neck and neck with growth incrementally outperforming value. I'd say going forward, a couple of things really have to happen to get some light of fire, if you will, under the value sort of styles. One is you probably do need need to have a confirmed bottom in economic momentum. You mentioned the ISM survey as the most popular survey of manufacturing activity. It's pretty rare for small caps to outperform and value stocks outperform without an improving trend in the ISM. So I think you want to see that going forward. You also probably want to see a continuation of the yield curve spread widening, which has really powered the financials trade. Clearly, spreads are very important to financials operating dynamic as well as operating earnings future. And as a result, when spreads widen in the yield curve, when corporate credit spreads tighten, financials generally tend to perform quite a bit better. So you want to see a little bit of follow through there. I'd say the third factor, and maybe less, a little bit less important, but still something that you want to look for to really power a value recovery is oil prices. It's pretty rare that on trend, value can outperform with oil prices at least rising. I don't know that you're going to get a breakout in oil prices, but you do need to have oil prices supporting the trade.
So given where the market is right now, what would you be telling investors to do as a strategist?
You know, our view on 2020 is that the bull market will continue, though it'll have to plod through the swamp. And by swamp, I mean there are a lot of political risks. There are, you know, obviously the impeachment trials are ongoing. You've got the 2020 election coming. I think that the gains in 2020 will be a little bit harder to come by than the gains in 2019. You have to remember that we started 2019 at a, you know, generationally oversold levels. We started 2019 at levels of absolute rock bottom investor confidence, and that's usually an extraordinary buying opportunity. 2020 is set up to be a little bit different. You know, investors are starting to pile in to the equity market, not en masse, but they are at least starting to pile in. And the political outlook is still a little bit more difficult. We've already repriced much easier monetary policy. So 2020 has to be about kind of showing up and companies actually producing the earnings growth that we priced in throughout 2019. We still think it will be an incrementally positive year, certainly not the year that we just had in 2019, but we are expecting a single-digit gain in stocks as implied by our fair value model. And we do think you want to start to orient your portfolios toward more cyclical sorts of names as opposed to the very highly defensive strategies that really dominated at least the middle portion of 2019.
Do you think this gets a little bit more volatile? I mean, nobody's really paying too much attention to the impeachment or politics, but let's say as we get closer to the convention where we have a clear-cut candidate and we get closer to the fall, politics play more of a role in the markets?
I think that you could see that happen. It really depends upon who the candidates are and what happens with the impeachment trials in the near term. I think it's really far, far, far too early to position your portfolios for some sort of projected outcome of the election. But as we do get closer to the summer months and we know who the candidates are and we can start to isolate the policies of those candidates, and importantly, we get a better sense of what's going to happen with the Senate and the House elections as well. So we understand what the distribution of the parties will be in Washington. You can more accurately price the prospects. That being said, you know, I think the last election is a perfect example of the markets really being caught off guard by the ultimate results. I think what we're finding around the world is polling is failing us in many ways. We're having a hard time sort of grasping what the population is actually going to do. We're having a hard time projecting what is going to actually be the result of some of these elections. So I would be a little bit wary of positioning purely around policy. I do think always and everywhere monetary policy is significantly more important than any other form of policy lever that you know, happens out of Washington, D.C. So I would keep a really close eye on what's happening with monetary policy as my guiding light, so to speak. Think about earnings and economic growth as the second factor that really drives stocks. And then to the extent that policy really truly will impact the economic outlook, you want to try to implement it in your strategy, but it's certainly not the driver.
All right. Well, listen, Gina, if our listeners would like to follow your work, you're a prolific writer, how can they do so?
Well, hopefully they will all be Terminal subscribers. My work is pretty exclusive to the Bloomberg Terminal and the Bloomberg subscribers. But if you do have a Bloomberg, you can follow our work at just by typing in my name, Gina Martin Adams. It's at BI Stocks is my homepage on the Terminal. You also, though, can find some of my work. I will post occasionally some of the snippets of what we do on LinkedIn. So you can look me up on LinkedIn and connect with me there, or on Twitter. Both of my LinkedIn and Twitter names are Gina Martin Adams. So I'd be happy to connect with anyone.
All right, Gina, thanks for joining us. And you have yourself a happy holiday and a happy new year.
Our premium members are able to hear the weekday Financial Sense Insider. If you're not a member, here's one of the interviews you missed this week.
This week, we had the pleasure of speaking with Jeff Christian, managing partner of CPM Group. He is one of the most accurate strategists and forecasters on precious metals and a wide range of commodity markets that we have on our show. We've been speaking with him for many, many years, and he issued a buy recommendation, long-term buy recommendation on both gold and silver back in November of 2000 at the very beginning of the big bull market. He was also on record talking about how things had just gotten way out of hand and crazy in 2011, right at the peak when silver was at $49 and when gold was at its all-time highs, and against many other people who are saying, oh yeah, they expected gold and silver to continue going parabolically or exponentially higher from those levels. He was saying, hey, this is a bubble. People are way too bullish, and they issued a sell recommendation right near the peak. And so it's really been a pleasure to have him on our show over the years to talk about where precious metals prices are headed. And actually, this week, he just issued an important buy recommendation. So we spoke with him about that on our show today, where he sees silver moving over the next 2 to 3 years if you're a longer term investor, and also got his thoughts on some of the things that are driving gold prices, both in the short term and the long term. Here's a clip of what he had to tell our audience.
You've got a kind of a bifurcated market right now. There's this incredible bullishness on the part of some people. This is the great, you know, this is the beginning of the next bull market, and prices are going to be $2,000 or $4,000 or $6,000 for gold and $1,000 for silver within a short period of time. And you're seeing that again. It's worrisome because if you look at what's happened since June, most of the buying that has pushed prices up has been in futures and options and forward markets. There's been some ETF buying, but you haven't seen the long-term physical investors buying gold bars and coins.
So if you want to listen to this full interview with Jeff Christian at CPM Group, again, one of the most accurate strategists in the precious metal space, all you have to do is go to financialsense.com and click the subscribe button. And also, if you haven't noticed, we're running a special holiday discount, $25 off, amounts to 2 months free when you purchase an annual subscription. So definitely take advantage of this holiday offer. All that you can find, again, at financialsense.com.
The market seems to be heading into higher territory. Everybody's optimistic about the consumer is the one segment of the economy that is holding up, despite a weakness in manufacturing. Joining us on the program is Greg Weldon from Weldon Online. Greg, we are in the Christmas season, one of the most important retail seasons of the year. It looks like online is dominating. Let's begin with consumer discretionary, because if you look at the S&P Spider XLY, it doesn't seem to be looking that good if the consumer is really that strong.
Now, Jim, you must be reading Weldon Live, because, yes, we just wrote about this really late last week, and certainly Monday was a big special on this. There's a lot going on here, so let's break it down. The first thing you got to talk about, of course, is Cyber Monday, $9 billion, huge number. That is equal to about the kind of year-over-year growth rate you've seen in non-store retail sales on a rolling 12-month basis. So it was a monster number. Having said that, one of the things we talked about really 6-8 weeks ago in a, you know, kind of preceding the holiday season, was that firms had some room to cut prices. You know, you had some flexibility here in terms of, you know, input prices were down. You've had a little bit of pricing power. It hasn't been as negatively wide, you know, margin, so to speak, at the final demand level, as they have been in the past. What this has done is given the retailer some pricing flexibility here, and in a very competitive environment, and for, frankly, a consumer dollar spent that may not grow as much in the past, we saw vicious discounting to reach that $9 billion mark. So that $9 billion bought a lot more than $9 billion worth of goods. So I might suggest, you know, to some degree, the consumer may already be spent to, you know, to some level. It's a shortened holiday season. You kind of have a lot working in there. But it's interesting, too, because this has been my theory. I wrote about this on Monday. I get a call from my daughter this morning, not kidding, out of the blue, not even, you know, she has no idea what I'm writing about or anything. And she says to me, Dad, you would not believe how much stuff I was able to buy with the money I had to spend on my boyfriend's family going out on Black Friday. So it's real. And it's not just envisioned that the setup is there, but we know it to be true. So that to me sets up expectations that are huge now for this season that are probably going to be disappointed. And in the macro sense, this is end game stuff. And here's why. You have inflation that is veiled considerably kind of by the decline in energy, which is now rolling off, by the way, on a year-over-year basis. So, you know, CPI numbers in the next 2-3 months are going to be really interesting. But the bottom line is you have core rate, you know, 2.3, 2.4, 2.5 was 2.7. You know, let's call it 2.4. All right. If you have stuff like parking, okay, urban bus fares, childcare, rent, I mean, the car repair was up big. I mean, the things that people have to pay that they don't want to pay, they don't want to have to pay more for parking. They don't want to pay more for the bus fare. It eats into their dollar to the point where you kind of are in a situation without growth in income. You don't have growth in discretionary spending. In fact, you have a contraction in discretionary spending because you're crowding discretionary spending out dollar for dollar by price increases in necessity. You've seen this. It was interesting because September retail sales are really disappointing. And the thought process was, well, this is when tariffs hit and there was a big trade headlines in September. If you recall, it was kind of the, you know, the meltdown of the trade situation. But the same numbers came in October. And it is weakness in every discretionary spending area except non-store retailers and eating and drinking establishments. And those are kind of like the last gasp things that people hold on to at the end. That's number one. And when we say, well, you know, without income, you don't have growth in retail sales. Average weekly earnings are down almost 100 points from their year-over-year high, which was at 3.6%. Okay, and that's from the labor market numbers, the employment numbers. Average weekly earnings, okay, not per hour. Great, if you're making more per hour, you're working less hours, you're taking home less money on the weekly basis. So, you know, it's nice to have greater hourly pay and greater hours worked and greater overtime, and that's a triple play. But what you have now is a retreat on a nominal basis of 100 basis point. Okay. And at the same time, you've got this stickiness and this rise to a sticky level in the price of necessities, which has driven the core inflation rate to, let's say, 2.4, 2.5. And all of a sudden you have, you know, 0.2 real average weekly wage gains on a year-over-year basis. 0.2. Okay. Down from a real growth of almost 2% a year ago. So it's collapsed. All right. That wage growth gone for all intents and purposes. And when you then take retail sales, okay, the year-over-year rate, even though you've had strong sales of some of this, you know, the staples, and you've had strong sales in automobiles, you know, relative to, they look like they're going to break down. They didn't. Now you have a real year-over-year growth rate in retail sales of 0.7%, down from over 4% about a year and a half ago. So these numbers are glaring. And then when you look at the XLY, all right, the XLY peaked first in 2006, declined 2007, led the entire stock market low into the crisis. Then it bottomed first and led the way out straight through to 2014. So from the, you know, St. Paddy's Day monetary massacre, March 17th, 2009, when they introduced, you know, TARP, TALF, QE1. From that day forward, it was the overlay of the century was to put forth the XLY, consumer credit, retail sales, and the S&P 500. It was virtually the same chart. Then when you threw the Fed's balance sheet into the mix, you saw why. All right. And that went through to 2014. You kind of had your taper, you know, tantrum, your taper to tap out tantrum. You saw the decline. You had 2015. You thought Hillary might win the election. You had a decline. And more recently then, it's led the way higher again on renewed credit growth on the jig you got from the tax cuts. All right. But kind of all that's gone. And you're starting to see the numbers now, they're eroding. And when you see the XLY has not made a new high in this move, it is not confirmed. And in fact, relative to the staples, it's breaking down. That's a very amazing tell in terms of the S&P 500. And more so when you just take the XLY against the S&P 500 as a ratio and then apply it on an overlay to the S&P 500, it's uncanny how it has led to the downside, bottom first, led to the upside, peaked first, and is now breaking down in a big way and threatening to lead to the downside. I think the yellow caution flag is waving wide and high on the U.S. consumer right now, and this is a big deal for the stock market.
Greg, let's talk about two other issues. If you were expecting a recovering economy, which is what economists are saying with the market taking off, Wouldn't you expect to see rising interest rates reflecting greater demand for credit and also rising gasoline prices with, you know, more trucks on the road? But we're not seeing that.
Definitely the first part of that, without a doubt. And you're not seeing that. And not only that, you're seeing the opposite. I mean, you're seeing a five-year note that's fluctuating within the band of the current federal funds policy rate target range. I mean, that's like, I mean, the yield curves, I mean, the 2-year, 5-year is perfectly flat. You have a situation where the market is still kind of, you know, looks like it's betting recession. I have disputed that thought process and that linkage until really now. And now the most recent downturn in bond yields and the most recent flattening of the yield curve, which is not yet across the board, for me, first of all, makes the 30-year look pretty dang attractive right here, frankly. But what's also interesting within this vein is how it ties back to the economy, because now, to me, this is a yellow caution flag waving unto itself. And when you take the dynamic around when we had the curve flattening before, what you didn't have was a narrowing in the U.S. bond yield premium against Europe, against other places in the globe. You did not have that. OK, because European yields were falling faster. So bond yields, actually, the U.S. premium expanded. It got to record highs. You're talking on the 30-year level. I mean, it's almost 300 basis points or higher. So you had, you know, this expansion in the yield premium in the U.S. holding up and actually supporting the dollar. That's gone. All right. And in the situation now where you saw the decline in bond yields this week, OK, and a massive, you know, outside downside reversals in yields across the spectrum of the yield curve. All right. And you have now the yield differentials against Europe narrowing dramatically, breaking down, violating the 2-year exponential moving average on the long end, which is the real tell, the 30-year spread, the bond, the T-bond against the Bund. And now you overlay that against the dollar. And now the dollar is in deep doo-doo, man. I'm telling you, we've been looking for this and waiting for this all year, and it hasn't happened until just recently. And to me, you take out this 95.50-ish level in the dollar index, and it's a major secular long-term breakdown against, you know, the recent rally, even into, you know, 2016, 17, 18. This entire rally is really Fibonacci against the whole dynamic of the dollar going all the way back to 1971. And this is where it gets really interesting. And I'll make one more point. The year-over-year rate of change in the dollar has gone from 9% to virtually zero very quickly. And as the dollar's cracking here, by the way, the other thing I'll point out is you have an emerging currency crisis in South America that no one's even talking about. All right. And the dollar is still breaking. Why? Because, of course, Brazilian real, Argentinian peso, you know, the Paraguay guaraní is not included in the dollar index. So to me, this is a sign of inherent weakness in the dollar. And when you kind of look at it this way, where the rate of change of the dollar index has gone from 9% year-over-year positive appreciation to virtually zero, okay? Well, if you want to measure the dollar in another way, okay, how much gold does the dollar buy? Well, the dollar gold ratio is actually down 15% year over year. And in currency terms, that's a big depreciation. So you've had, to me, this stealth depreciation in the dollar that really hasn't shown up yet in some of the intermarket or intramarket dynamics that's about to. So it kind of bodes well for some of the commodities here, too, as well. And certainly that leads into a bullish discussion around the precious metals.
Yeah, let's move to that section next, because gold, silver, the gold stocks have been stellar performers this year. We've got a little bit of a pullback here, but if the dollar begins to weaken, we should see gold start to break out even further. Right now, it looks almost like a flag formation on the charts, which is looking very positive. So let me get your take on gold and silver here.
Sure. Well, it's interesting because silver made its big correction. I mean, it was just perfect, man. I mean, you took it down to, you know, the 200-day moving average, the zone between the 50 and 61% retracement level. It was an ABC pattern. It came in with the long-term moving averages perfectly, which have not even yet fully realigned bullishly. So you had the first breakout, you've had the big turn, you have your correction, and now you're coming off that level. And the thought process was gold had more open interest than did silver, and was gold a little too heavy in terms of the length of the market? And I thought it was, and you thought it might crack and you might just get one more last gas to the downside here, but it didn't happen. All right. You held 1446. You held the long-term, I mean, rather the medium-term moving averages. Didn't even crack the 100-day exponential moving average in gold. I mean, it's phenomenal performance. And then you got kind of a mini double bottom. And all of a sudden you're back above 1480. If you get above 1520, you know, correction done, over, that's it. And I think that ties in with the dollar story. It ties in with the interest rate differential story. It ties in with the consumer story that the Fed's going to have to, you know, be looked at to be more aggressive down the road, let alone what's the ECB going to do next. I mean, they can't cut rates again. It's not going to work. So, you know, their next thing, the next rabbit they're going to pull out of a hat is going to be something magnificent. We've talked about that, what that might be in the past. What that could be very bullish for gold. So I think you had a chance here. And one of the ones I might point out is AU, Anglo Gold Ashanti. I mean, this thing has been an upside leader. All right. It had a pullback, shallow. Maybe it was over. You almost thought maybe you had the first shallow pullback and we were willing to get long there and it was too early. We're willing to get long here again, especially when you look at something like AU, because it came down and made a perfect double bottom. I think it was 1804. And it's skyrocketed, you know, since it hit that low. And to me, that was a big tell, because if AU had broken down as an upside leader, it meant we had a deeper correction coming. That didn't happen. Everything's turned. And more importantly, Jim, I mean, the SIL is in a position to lead here. It is breaking out against the price of silver, which gives you the Goldilocks setup we always want in precious metals. If the dollar's cracking and the silver's leading gold and the mining shares are leading the metals and the SIL is leading everything, then that's your perfect alignment of bullish constellations, you know, for gold. And you're kind of on top of that. And we've looked at some of the silver stocks, and actually one of the websites we're running now is called goldguru.com, and it's gold-guru.com. I do a lot of quant work too. So, you know, we combine everything, technical, psychology, fundamentals, macro, monetary, and some quant work that I wrote algorithms all the way back in the 80s. I'm an old, you know, old school geek science and math guy. So within that context, we picked the three like dollar silver mining shares. Two, I think, are from Australia, one's from Canada. Like literally, here are option plays. These are call options, man. You know, take a couple $1,000, throw them into these, you know, virtual penny stocks. I don't want to call them that, but you know, it's venture capital like, you know, equities here. May not even be pulling metal out of the ground, but who cares? Because they're takeover targets. When the metal in the ground is, you know, worth enough, you know. And then the other thing I like here too, by the way, Pan American Silver has been a perennial favorite of mine. It's been a severe underperformer since it peaked in 2016. And it has come roaring out of the gates here. It is not only breaking out on its own right now on a long-term technical basis, but it is a big pattern, long-term stuff breaking out against the price of silver. And to me, that's the most encouraging thing you could say right now. The setup here is so much better than it was 6 weeks ago. It's not even funny. And with the dollar in play, I think you have something special about to happen in the precious metals.
Greg, summing up, as we're looking at the market right now, you see signs of weakness coming from the consumer. We got an ISM manufacturing report this week that shows that manufacturing continues to contract. And you have the dollar, as you mentioned, year over year, it's gone nowhere. And it looks like it's ready for a breakdown and gold is ready to take off. So if you were playing this market right now as an investor, what would you be doing? Would you be putting your money, allocating a little bit more to precious metals, given your risk tolerance, keeping money on the sidelines in cash? What would you be doing?
All of that. No, I don't. Well, it depends. I mean, each individual investor is different. That's why we try and offer different opportunities in our research products, you know, for people to do different things. I mean, protection is the buzzword here. Number one, if that is, you know, if you're a risk averse, you know, person and you're looking to protect your money, that's fine. I would think that protection would include some element of precious metals for sure. I think it's time to get aggressive. I think it's time. These are times when, you know, we're helping our clients navigate and potentially survive this, but that's not good enough, man. We need to thrive right here, because I think the opportunities that are coming down the pike are just enormous. It's once in a decade type stuff in some of the markets where you can make a lot of money in a short period of time. And I think the precious metals area is absolutely one of them. I think really looking at the most aggressive plays in some of the silver mining shares is a way to enhance the return of the certain portfolio, certainly to smooth out your volatility if the stock market's going to get whacked here. And I think the probabilities are going up every day that that's going to happen. But I also think diversification into other things. And this is where, you know, you know me, Jim, I've been 36 years doing this. I started at Florida Comex. I've worked at Prue, at Lehman. I've worked at two of the biggest hedge funds in the world, you know, and I've been doing it on my own for 21 years. I am always an advocate of the futures markets. If you can't have a futures account, all right, and you can't find someone good enough, you know, that's a CTA like we are, you know, to entrust your money to. And frankly, you have to have a lot to do that. Okay. And you can't mess around in a futures markets. They're misunderstood, but mathematically you can control them. But most people don't understand the math. That's why we did the futures trading bootcamp back earlier in the year to help people, you know, like 6 hours worth of stuff in there, everything you need to know. But if you can't do it, there are ways in the ETFs, in the equity space to take advantage of this stuff. A recent example is we got our clients long coffee, and the JO is the coffee ETF, and it has absolutely exploded. I think the opportunities in some of the agricultural commodities markets are worth taking a look at. Stuff like cotton, sugar, even orange juice. I mean, the crop here in Florida has, you know, been decimated by disease. You take even soybeans. I think the soybean market is still mispriced. I really do. I think you get an 8 handle on soybeans. That's a gift going into the next year. Let's not forget, and people tend not to even understand, let alone forget, because they never remembered or knew. You are on the borderline of a massive currency crisis in South America. Every one of those major currencies, except for the Peruvian sol, is the only one that has not made a new record low here. Record low. Against the dollar. Do you hear that on TV at all? Do you hear Squawk Box talking about, you know, what's going on in Chile, a constitutional crisis? What's going on in Argentina, where the currency is down so much where farmers can barely pay to maintain their crops? What's going on in Venezuela, which we all know about, but no one talks about, and it gets worse every single day. It's a human tragedy of monumental proportions, and nobody talks about it. But the fact of the matter is, this affects a lot of markets. And particularly affected in my mind are some of the agricultural commodities that these countries produce. And right in there is coffee. You're already seeing the reaction. I think sugar is a big potential winner. We got a couple other. If you want to, you know, check out our research, you'll be able to, you know, check all of that out. But I think, you know, the JO and, you know, the cotton is the BAL, and these things change. The ETFs are tough. They're all different. They all treat taxes differently. They all readjust differently. They're kind of a pain in the butt, to be honest with you. But in this case, I think they're going to offer tremendous opportunity. And in particular, I'd be watching the DBC, which is the overall tracking commodity tracker ETF, and then the DBA on the verge of a breakout. If the DBA gets above 17.25, you absolutely want to own it. I think it has huge potential. It's violating a 12-year downtrend line. It's the one sector of commodities that did not make a new high in 2011. So I think there's great opportunities out there if you are willing to, you know, just to do a little homework and be diversified and take some risk.
All right, Greg, as we close, if our listeners would like to find out more about Weldon Online and your new gold service, tell them how they could do so.
Sure, thanks. I mean, you know, we have the boot camps, which is on my WeldonOnline.com website. That is where you'll find Weldon Live, which is our kind of our bigger product. It covers the global markets. We offer, you know, trades and currencies. Here's a bonus for your listeners. We just bought the Kiwi dollar today, okay, against the U.S. dollar, Kiwi dollar futures. Looking to buy the African Rand, too. So we trade everything. And I think you have to trade everything, because this way your odds of catching the 3 or 4 big moves in a year are just greatly enhanced. So, and already coffee is playing out as one of the biggest moves of the fourth quarter. So that's WeldonOnline.com, Weldon Live. It's not overly expensive, but, you know, it's a little more expensive than the GoldGuru.com. And that's gold hyphen, you know, the symbol hyphen there, just a dash, GoldGuru.com. That's like $60 a month. If you buy it for a year, we give you 2 months for free. I mean, for what you get, that's like, people are stealing from me, Jim. So, and I'm happy to let them do it, because we started it in response for demand. When we did the Gold Investor Bootcamp, which is available on gold-guru.com, the response was overwhelming. And people were asking questions. And this time I'm like, I need to restart the gold. Remember, I used to do the metal monitor. And I used to actually do the official metal monitor. It was the official precious metals research for Prudential at the time. So we started the goldguru.com, and the response has been phenomenal. And frankly, the stock picks on there, we've hit it out of the park already. I mean, people that have been on there with us since we started it back in August, I mean, they've paid for multiple years of goldguru.com just in a couple of months.
All right. Well, listen, Greg, as always, pleasure having you on the program. Happy holidays to you.
You too, Jim. Thanks so much. And you do a great job. My hat's off to you.
Should you buy and hold at market tops? At Financial Sense Wealth Management, we believe valuations, leading economic indicators, and other metrics are essential for prudent investing to both identify long-term opportunities and to minimize risk. Every day, we keep a watchful eye on the markets, continually assessing the investment landscape so you can focus on the things that matter most. Don't put your hard-earned wealth at risk. Give us a call at 888-486-3939. That's 888-486-3939. Securities offered through Financial Sense Securities Incorporated, member FINRA and SIPC. Advisory services offered through Financial Sense Advisors, a registered investment advisor.
Chris Poplava, Chief Investment Officer for Financial Sense Wealth Management, joins us today. And Chris, last time we had you on The Big Picture, we talked about how we are seeing an uptick in global leading economic indicators. However, you're saying how you expected a continued deceleration for growth here in the United States, and that also you were starting to position clients more towards international and emerging market areas, given the fact that we are seeing an uptick in LEIs in those areas. Give us an update on where things stand today. Have there been any major changes to your outlook when you look into 2020?
No, there haven't. When I'm looking at data for across the world, I'm still seeing an improvement there. And I'm getting confirmation from the market when looking at global interest rates. You know, if you look at developed interest rates coming from Germany, those are beginning to move higher. Japan, those interest rates are moving higher, a little bit more so than the U.S., but I do think that we've seen a bottom in growth globally, and I think we've seen a bottom, therefore, in interest rates. And I'm expecting growth to continue to improve as well as interest rates to move higher, but not at the quick pace that we saw in 2018 when rates moved up aggressively. I think rates will gradually move up in the next few months or so.
Now, it's fascinating because the last time we had you on, we talked about how when we're thinking about sentiment here in the U.S., there was a measure that we were looking at, and we posted a chart looking at put-call ratios and how they were extremely stretched to show that there was a lot of optimism, euphoria by investors. And since that time, the stock market, U.S. stock market, has basically traded flat. We had a major move to the upside on news about China looking into its intellectual property rights. That led to a short-term spike, and then we fell back down once Trump said that it was unlikely we were to see, or hinted that we may not see, a trade deal until after his election. So basically, since that last time we spoke with you, talking about excessive sentiment and optimism by investors, the stock market has basically traded flat with a lot of volatility. What is the pulse of the stock market at present for, let's say, the S&P 500, for example?
I think sentiment, you know, looking at a couple of measures, does show some elevated sentiment, which means the market, you know, may trade sideways to slightly down over the couple coming weeks here, absent, you know, some positive headline news. I think just today, Larry Kudlow was talking about things are progressing well with China. You just have to wait a few hours and you get a different headline about China and the U.S. But, you know, I do think that we're probably going to have a, you know, decent Santa Claus year-end rally. You know, seasonally, December is typically a great month for the year. Absent, you know, last year, that was a very, you know, abnormal aberration in the historical pattern for the market in December. Additionally, you know, a lot of what's been propelling the market higher over the last few years is corporate buybacks. And you typically see November, December as the two biggest periods for corporate buybacks to be executed. So I think, you know, any weakness we see in the market, I think, you know, you're going to see buyback desks begin to pick up more shares and kind of support the market. But, you know, I think there is a lot of support for the market with those buybacks plus seasonality. And again, absent some negative headline news, you know, I think we'll kind of finish moderately higher at the end of the year.
One thing that I know that you look at is leading economic indicators for the U.S. Again, as we discussed last time, you were saying how we are seeing global LEIs pick up. You're also seeing that corroborated, as you just mentioned a little bit earlier, with interest rates around the globe also picking up, confirming the uptick in economic data abroad. Let's talk about the U.S. here a little bit more. I know that you have a Financial Sense leading economic indicator that you have developed. What is it telling you about where U.S. is in its growth cycle currently?
It's suggesting that we're going to be seeing a bottom in the conference board's leading economic indicator probably in the first quarter of next year. The one that I've developed has a few more inputs than the conference board. It also tends to turn prior to the conference board. For example, in the last cycle when we saw growth peak in 2014, and bottom in 2016, our LEI bottomed in the first quarter of 2016, while the conference board didn't bottom until the middle part of the year. And additionally, our indicator peaked in early 2017, remained positive and at a high growth level, but it was starting to decelerate going into 2018 and suggested that, you know, the strength in the U.S. Manufacturing and economic growth was probably overstated. And what was interesting was a study done by Market, which calculates their own PMI relative to the Institute of Supply Management's PMI, was showing that the high level reading in the US PMI for manufacturing in 2017-18 was overstating growth. So it does kind of show that what we were measuring was probably more accurate, that manufacturing wasn't as strong as perceived. And that was why we were predicting a peak in US growth late 2018. And our indicator now has bottomed, and we've seen two back-to-back months of improvement. And a lot of that is coming from housing data. Housing data has been uniformly strong over the last couple of months here. And it argues that we're probably going to see a bottom in the conference board's LEI in the coming months. And part of the reason why that's very significant and important is historically the conference board's leading economic indicator's growth rate turns negative well before the onset of a recession. By the time a recession hits, oftentimes I believe it's at a negative 3% or -4% growth rate. So if we can hold at neutral and begin to stabilize, that does say that the chance of a U.S. recession is diminishing. And that will be obviously very important for the market going forward.
So again, the Financial Sense leading economic indicator that you've developed, which leads the conference board's leading economic index, so it's a leading of a leading indicator, we should say, it is showing a bit of a stabilization and even an upturn here in the U.S. So as long as we see that continue, that's giving a somewhat favorable view, we should say. And again, as I think you mentioned, our own leading economic indicator here is mirroring what we see with the PMI data, especially out of Market, which is diverging with the ISM manufacturing data, but that's a much wider, has a much more breadth to it, looking at many more companies than the ISM. So I know that that's one indicator that you look at when we think about this debate over whether to follow the Market manufacturing or the ISM manufacturing indicator. So it looks like our own leading economic indicator is mirroring what we see with the Market manufacturing data as well. So it may be that we're looking at an important inflection, as we've been discussing with you in the past, not just in global growth, but also some stabilization here in the U.S. Chris, let's talk about Market internals right now, because I know that this is something that you look at to address the strength of the stock market. What do you see on that side of things?
When looking at breadth at the S&P 500 index, I'm seeing a lot of strength in the financial sector, in the healthcare, and in the industrial sector. Those are important because of the size that they have within the S&P 500. While I'm seeing continued weakness in the energy sector, which, you know, is really no surprise seeing that oil hasn't gone anywhere in the last few months here. Now, if oil does start to improve in the coming months, we get that one lagging sector in the S&P begin to improve, that would be bullish for the market. Overall, you know, seeing the industrial sector being one of the strongest sectors in terms of breadth, hitting new highs, the S&P financial sector today hit a 52-week high. These are signs of a confirmation that we've likely seen a bottom and inflection point in global growth. Industrials, you know, have a lot of exports to the rest of the world, very sensitive to the manufacturing growth rate of the country and the globe, does kind of confirm that thought that we've had a couple months ago that we were nearing an inflection point in the global economic cycle.
One thing that we discussed on FS Insider this week that I wanted to bring up with you, Chris, is a conversation we had with Richard Duncan at MacroWatch. And what he talked about is how, and this is something he's been writing about and saying now for years, is that capitalism is dead. It has been dead since the 70s, since the dollar gold peg broke, and that now we're operating under a system he calls creditism, where economic growth is dependent upon credit growth, not on private capital, which is how capitalism traditionally would run, and as most people conceive of classical economic theory. So we're operating under a new environment, is his argument. And the argument that he's been making now ever since the Fed started quantitative tightening last year was that they would have to ultimately reverse course because credit was shrinking in the economy and we would end up going into recession unless the Fed did an about face. Of course, that's what we saw happen this year. And he said to FS Insider this week that this was one of the most extraordinary monetary policy U-turns we've seen in history. I want to bring this up with you because I know that you have a thin air credit measure. I believe this is inspired by someone else that you follow, an economist. But tell us about what you are seeing when it comes to thin air credit and Fed's injections into the economy right now.
I got that notion of thin air credit from Paul Kasriel. He was one of the top economists at Northern Trust. And essentially, it's looking at the aggregate credit in the U.S. in terms of those who have the ability to create credit, where, you know, creating credit is not taking away from someone else's assets. So it's actually introducing new money into the system. And that is looking at commercial banks plus Fed credit growth. And, you know, years ago when we were, you know, launching QE 1, 2, and 3, you know, we used to look at the year-over-year growth rate in commercial bank credit and looking at the year-over-year growth in Fed credit. And it was essentially the yin and yang. So, you know, I was essentially predicting when the Fed would start QE just by looking at when U.S. commercial bank credit would be approaching a zero growth rate. And we're seeing that again, where U.S. commercial bank credit growth was beginning to slow, and we naturally saw kind of a tight liquidity issue, and the Fed naturally stepped in, where we're now seeing total thin air credit growth, which hit a peak at the end of 2013 when the Fed began to taper with a 10% year-over-year growth rate. We've been decelerating ever since. And the bottom in that growth was about roughly 1% late in 2018, right when we were having the liquidity issues in the market and the S&P had a mini bear market in the fourth quarter. Since that time, we've been slowly improving. But since the announcement of the Fed going back in, starting up QE again, we've now gone from a 1% growth rate in the second quarter to now over a 4.5% year-over-year growth rate in U.S. credit. So we're definitely seeing a lot more support in the system from the Fed trying to improve the amount of liquidity.
And that's a pretty stark contrast to what we saw last year, right? I mean, we think about the end of the year around Christmas. Last year, the Fed was tightening. They were talking about raising interest rates. Of course, they did make their about face right after we saw the stock market crater by double digits. But at this point now, we're seeing the Fed inject money. I believe the U.S. government is also fairly loose. I mean, if you look at budget deficits, they're at levels that we typically see in recessions. So, I mean, it looks like the government is spending money, the Fed is spending money. So this is providing, I would think, a tailwind for the economy and for the market as well, wouldn't you say?
I would. I mean, if you look at the Fed, we've got monetary stimulus. There's a tremendous amount of fiscal stimulus in terms of the amount of debt that's being issued. And it's, you know, essentially kind of moving towards the, I'm sure, you know, it's been a popular term, the modern monetary theory, where the government issues debt and the central bank monetizes it. That's, you know, the Fed is almost being forced into that. And, you know, one of the problems we've seen over the last 12 months was that at the U.S. Treasury auctions, that the amount of take-up by foreigners, by other institutions was falling such that the primary dealers who are running these auctions had to take the balance. And we saw the amount of dealer or government security positions by the primary dealers absolutely explode in the last 12 months. For example, in the middle part of 2018, there was roughly just under $100 billion in Treasury securities owned by the primary dealers. That began to spike in the third quarter to about $150 billion, and then it began to decline a little bit. But we saw a massive jump in the fourth quarter going into the first quarter of this year, where their assets went from roughly $100 billion all the way to $250 billion. That's, you know, $250 billion. And that was right around the time where the Fed essentially reversed course. Beginning in January, the Fed began to hint that they were done raising interest rates, which they did. And then later in the spring, they announced that they were going to begin tapering their reductions in their balance sheet. And then they followed that even further in the summer by finally starting to cut interest rates. So we saw, you know, a tightness in the system where the primary dealers were having to soak up more and more of the debt issuance issued by the government, and as the primary or as the market was not uptaking that. Now, I have heard some interesting theories regarding the primary dealers and the big banks and the liquidity issues in the repo market. One theory that I heard, which there could be some credit to this, is that some of the biggest banks in the country are intentionally withholding liquidity from the market, holding back lending, slowing that down. And the thought behind that is that they might be doing that to create issues in the market, to create a narrative that they're now being overregulated, that their capital controls are too high, and that's creating problems in the system, with the hope that the government will then come in and begin to loosen controls and regulation on the banks so that they can lend at higher leverage ratios and have a higher profitability.
Was that something that Jeff Gundlach just recently talked about? I remember him making some comments along this lines of this being a theory that's being floated around there.
Actually, it was from, we heard this as a thought from another investment bank, another Wall Street firm that, you know, we visit with and we meet with to get their outlooks. You know, they weren't going public with this. Obviously, they didn't want any bad press. But their thought was that, you know, according to their internal research and thought process on what other big banks were doing, that this was likely the case. So I didn't hear this from Gundlach, but this was actually from another Wall Street firm where, you know, they were basically kind of espousing that they think this is what's going on between some of the larger banks in the country.
Very fascinating. Okay, yeah. And I remember the thing that Gundlach was bringing up was about how Trump may actually be trying to engineer a slowdown through the U.S.-China trade war to force the Fed's hand to be loose and then ultimately create enough momentum going into the election so that we would be able to stave off a recession, but also give enough of a tailwind from the Fed by forcing their hand prior to his election. That, I think that was what he was talking about. Does that sound familiar?
It does. You know, Gundlach was one of the few people who, even before the Republican primaries, predicted that Trump would win the presidential election, and he did. And recently, he was on Yahoo in an extensive interview, and they asked him his thoughts. And he feels, absent a bear market or recession, that Trump will likely be reelected next year. And he said he wouldn't be surprised if a lot of the global slowdown and U.S. slowdown that we've seen because of the trade war was caused by Trump intentionally, essentially trying to force the Fed's hand to stop tightening, to begin to loosen monetary controls, and that he will depress the economy with a trade war with China and then magically come up with a trade deal, sell it to everyone as it's the best deal ever, and, you know, fight another day with China after he's been reelected. So if that's the case, and he does announce a trade deal, we've got monetary stimulus, we've got a positive resolution to a trade deal, and we have a further fiscal stimulus, we could see the S&P hit new all-time highs going into next year, which would solidify, you know, Trump's reelection in the 2020 elections. And this is something touched upon by Morgan Stanley. Recently, I saw their 2020 outlook, and they're neutral on the market. You know, they don't see much upside for the U.S., partly because they really don't see any earnings growth going into 2020, while the consensus is, I believe, roughly a 10% earnings growth, which they pretty much put that consensus every year, and then it gets revised with reality. But their consensus view is zero earnings growth in the U.S., which is why they're sticking with the defensives. But they did have different scenarios. One of the scenarios, which is a pro-cyclical scenario, would be that trade tensions reach a positive resolution and with possible rollbacks of tariffs, which means that growth would improve faster than their economics team would expect, and that rates would move up more sharply than what they expect, which would be bullish for financials, and that it would be a better growth environment overall, and it would lead to a higher market. So that is something that they have as a scenario. It's not their base case, but it's definitely there. And, you know, another scenario they have is a growth scare where, you know, escalations with China develop even further, which would mean that we'd likely have a significant, possibly double-digit correction in the S&P next year if their growth scare scenario plays out.
Chris, as we close things, anything else that you were looking at on the currency, bond, or commodity front? One thing that I do want to bring up is we spoke with Jeff Christian, one of the most accurate forecasters and strategists on the precious metal space. We spoke with him this week on FS Insider, and he gave a pretty big call, one that has not happened in years, and that was an intermediate buy signal on silver. And he said, you know, this is if you have a time frame of about 2 to 3 years. So if you're a longer term investor, you know, don't expect silver to go up overnight, but they are putting an intermediate buy signal on silver. Again, on the gold market, as we discuss, he is bullish long term, a little bit of short term caution there. But I thought that was a pretty significant statement that he made this week. But anything that you're looking at, either currency, bonds, or commodity wise?
I would actually agree with Jeff. One of the things that I was looking at earlier this year in the spring was seeing a significant move in gold while silver was significantly lagging behind the price of gold. And in the spring, the gold-silver ratio was north of 90 to 1. And I believe going back to the early 1990s, the average ratio was roughly 66 to 1. So that was more than a two standard deviation event, which means that it was very statistically significant of how much gold had outperformed silver. And that was the highest the ratio has been since the early 1990s. So we were essentially at a three-decade high in the price of gold relative to silver. So I thought there was a tremendous amount of value in silver earlier this spring. Now, you know, around the summer, silver did begin to outperform gold and it played catch up. But even right now, with where the price of gold and silver are, I believe the ratio is still in the high 80s. So I still believe that silver has a brighter outlook than gold does going into next year, particularly if I'm correct that the global economy is bottoming and we should see a mild improvement going into next year, given the industrial demand component that silver has relative to gold. So I am very bullish on silver going into next year. One of the things that's been very encouraging that you typically see during bullish turns in silver and in gold is when the mining stocks outperform the physical commodity. And if you look at the price of silver since September, we've seen a significant decline, you know, correcting that huge move we saw in the summer. While if you look at the silver miners, they've essentially treaded water. They haven't gone anywhere. And even this week, some of the larger silver producers, pure play silver producers, hit 52-week highs, some of them even 2-3-year highs. So I think that does indicate there's a lot more strength within the silver market than would be noticed if you were just looking at the price of silver. So I'm in full agreement with Jeff, and I do think there's some significant opportunity in silver, which is an investment we have made for our more growth-oriented clients. We have been buying silver earlier this year, and we do have a position in it.
Well, Chris, if any of our listeners are interested in Financial Sense Wealth Management Services, whether or not that's 401k consulting, portfolio management, or even just to discuss some of the things that we brought up today regarding your outlook and what we're doing for clients, what's the best way to contact you?
They can call our office at 888-486-3939, or they can email me at chris.paplava@financialsense.com.
Chris, it was a pleasure having you on the show again. We look forward to speaking with you in the weeks ahead.
Thanks, Chris. It was a pleasure being on.
The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the Financial Sense staff and do not take into account listener suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies mentioned in Financial Sense or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.